T-minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T-minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for QNN20K.
T-minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T-minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T-minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4,
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. In this segment, we are speaking to author John Washburn. Hello, John.
Hello.
You have written a couple of articles, well, a few even before that. The Death of Tippit, and this is, I'm going to go with part one, two, and three, and it is at Kennedy's and King, and I haven't spoken to you before, so thank you for coming on and making time for Black Op Radio today.
Thank you for having me. I think it was Jim who put me in touch, so thank you. Yes, thank you for having
great.
Me.
Great. Right, and we're going to make links to the Kennedy's and King website from Jim DiEugenio. Anyway, today we're talking about the JFK assassination, and as I just mentioned, your first article we're going to talk about is part one, The Death of Tippit, Where Was Westbrook? What got you interested in this angle of research?
What got me interested was some stuff came up on YouTube regarding Dorothy Kilgallen, and that then threw me into something that Jim had written on it. That then kind of triggered memories from years ago of doubts about the ballistics in the Kennedy case, which I won't go into, but I find it very difficult to believe that there was three shots from the back, and just need to look at the Zapruder film for that. What I then did was I found the tape on YouTube of Dallas Police Department radio from 12:15 through to 1:15, and rather than being interested in what I call the gruesome bits of the assassination at the point that the tape has static due to a stuck microphone, I started listening to where Tippit's voice came in. And the first thing I picked up was that although all the official transcripts say Tippit's last call was at Lancaster at 8th, note that Lancaster in English as well as US English is three syllables, Tippit actually said Lansing at 8th. I looked at a map of Dallas and I was quite astounded to see that there is a Lansing Street two blocks from Lancaster at 8th. I then listened to the tape a bit more, and I heard that Officer Engel, whose call wasn't transcribed at all, had also been there 10 minutes earlier. And he actually says in the call to the dispatcher, still at Lansing and 8th. I then did some digging and I found the Warren Commission transcript of Bud Owens, Sergeant Bud Owens, who was supposed to be Tippit's supervisor that day, that shift. And if you read Owens' testimony, he lets out some pretty inconvenient facts. First of all, that Tippit's control was taken off him over lunchtime for reasons he didn't want to divulge. And he states that Tippit's control shifted to the same sergeant that was in charge of Engel. You can deduce from other evidence there that that must have been Sergeant Hugh Davis. So something that no one else I'm aware of has followed through is that the policeman who was murdered, the policeman who was shot, had covertly changed command from Owens to Davis. What I then found when I started looking at the tape in even more detail was how many out-of-place officers there were in Oak Cliff. One officer, Parker, who was supposed to be in Garland, and in fact the Warren Commission inventory of officers said he was doing roadblocks in Garland, was actually on one of the viaducts in Oak Cliff. I then found another officer, Officer Lewis, who was supposed to be from the Love Field area of Dallas, again, North Dallas. He was on the end of another viaduct. I then stumbled across the 2013 interview of Officer Ronald Nelson, and Nelson stated that he was on the end of a viaduct. He said that he was on the west side of Commerce Street Viaduct, heard the shots, drove across to Dealey Plaza, and saw people still carrying on the ground. That's particularly interesting for several reasons, not because there's now a pattern of officers being where they shouldn't be, because Nelson, by the official line of account, was in South Dallas and didn't move towards Central Dallas, Oak Cliff, until a radio call at 12:15, while Nelson was in Dealey Plaza at 12:30, having been on the other side of Connor Street Viaduct. So there's a clear pattern here of officers out of place where their positions were covered up by not transcribing, by mistranscribing. And as in the case of Nelson, and I think Tippett at 12:45, can only conclude that that call actually is a fake. It was added after the event. And if you get used to Tippett's voice on the tape, the person saying where Tippett is at 12:45 is not Tippett, and the person speaking on behalf of Nelson is not Nelson. What then transcribed, I thought, well, if you've got all these cops out of place on the end of viaducts, we then get this post-Warren Commission story about Tippett being at Gloco. And I looked at the Dale Myers timeline as a bit of a foil, because he's very keen to push Tippett being at Gloco as far forward in time as possible, i.e. around about 1 p.m., because that fits with his timeline of Tippett being shot at about 1:16. We all know that, according to Temple Bowley, he'd already been shot by the time he arrived at about 1:10. I then looked properly at what Bill Drennis had written on his website about Tippett's movements. And he said that the guys at Gloco were very insistent that Tippett arrived very soon after the shots were fired in Dealey Plaza. In fact, one of them said he had arrived before. Now, the thing that interested me about the literal use of the words after the shots were fired, I don't think if you've heard about an assassination secondhand, you would use the term after the shots had fired. I think you'd use the term, you know, after I'd heard somebody in a car coming and telling me there'd been an assassination, etc., etc. If you tie that in with Nelson, who clearly could hear the shots from the other side of the Trinity River on the west side of the Commerce Street Viaduct, come up with a conclusion that Gloco isn't that much further. It's about just over a mile in the case of the Commerce Viaduct, and Gloco is just a little bit further along. So if you could hear shots where Nelson said he heard the shots, I think you'd hear them at Gloco. That therefore puts Tippett arriving at the Gloco service station, gas station, at about the same time all the other officers were in odd positions on other viaducts. Why are they there before an assassination? Why are they there before they could have reacted to the assassination? You can only conclude that they were up to something before the assassination had actually happened, which ties in with the idea that there was somehow a degree of involvement in the assassination plans of certain officers within the Dallas Police Department. I wouldn't for one instance say that any of them were involved as shooters. I don't believe that Badge Man is a policeman. I don't think you can get that level of resolution from a Polaroid photograph. So I don't believe that Tippett or anybody from the police force was actually firing in Dealey Plaza. I would imagine that the assassination itself would be far more professional than that. But what I do think happened, the only way I can piece together the facts as evidence I've got, is if they were somehow just assisting getaways. So if there were shots from the front towards the underpass, the natural escape route out of Dealey Plaza would be towards Oak Cliff area. And therefore, some of those police officers would merely just need to ensure that there was safe passage for those people with the getaway. Nelson's movements in particular are very interesting, given that he was in Dealey Plaza at just after 12:30, about 12:31. He then leaves Dealey Plaza because he says clear. And then about 20 minutes later, he's coming back saying he's on the south end of Houston Street Viaduct. Now, I looked at what other movements Nelson might be involved in, and it does overlap very well with Roger Craig and others' observation that Oswald, on leaving the depository, ran down the bank and got into a Nash Rambler. That would therefore fit with Nelson's role, being assisting the Nash Rambler, taking Oswald to the Texas Theatre. That's my supposition as to what was going on. The timing works exactly for that distance. So all I think Nelson needs to do was follow the Rambler, make sure it didn't get intercepted or picked up by any other police officers going about their normal duties, and then he returned to Ely Plaza.
Yeah, this is fascinating, because the more we dig into this, the more it confirms that there's something going on here, a complete operation, and with the cooperation of so many people, and, you know.
Yeah, it is particularly interesting. The district commander, Lieutenant Fulham, was moved out of Dallas that day. He was sent to traffic school up in Illinois. That's why Owens took over as commander of the district, which therefore shifted personnel around such that Davis took control basically of all officers in Oak Cliff. We then had Menzel, Officer Menzel, supposedly having lunch in Luby's restaurant just opposite the Texas Theater, just about a block along, very close to where Tippit was seen at about 1 p.m., entering top 10 records and using the telephone but not speaking. Menzel's Warren Commission testimony is very interesting if you compare it to the radio, because he said in his Warren Commission testimony that he didn't know the president had been shot. He made use of the payphone in the restaurant to try to get through to DPD headquarters, but couldn't. And therefore, he didn't know until 1 o'clock that the president had been shot. That's completely betrayed by listening to the radio, because one of the very first calls after the stuck microphone had caused a radio blackout, at about 12:33, 12:34, Menzel appears twice on the radio giving his call sign, and you can hear sirens in the background, and you can hear that something really major is going on. There's no way that Menzel was incommunicado in the restaurant, not knowing that an assassination had taken place. He was on the radio, so he was out of the restaurant, he was in his car, and he would have known what was going on. So Menzel's a very interesting character. One of the articles I wrote picked up that none of Menzel's calls up until about the time after the death of Tippit got transcribed at all. And the effect of that is to basically support his Warren Commission testimony that he was incommunicado. But you start to look at the radio pattern, he wasn't incommunicado at all. He was using his radio.
Wow. Now, what was the catalyst for you to go through these? What gave you the suspicion that there would be more on the actual audio than it was written in the transcript?
It was the picking up that Engel's call hadn't been transcribed. So you have a man who's in the same place as the last destination of the police officer who gets shot, and his call isn't transcribed, even though it's very, very clear. You can't miss it on the tape. Some of the calls are quite indistinct. That one wasn't at all. It was very, very clear. And the thing then just starts to snowball, really, and then you start to pick up a pattern. And the other question I had was, well, what could Tippit have been doing at Gloco if he was at Gloco at about 12:32, 12:35? Of course, as many others have written, that would have been the route taken by the Marcellus bus that Oswald was supposed to have got on Elm Street. And had the traffic not been stuck, it would have got to Gloco at about 12:48, 12:50. But as we know, whoever was on the bus got off. And I therefore assumed that there must have been some reason for that person to get off. And Tippit was described as leaving Gloco at speed, heading in the direction of Lancaster Avenue, which I said is only two blocks over from Lansing and 8th, where he was making his call at 12:54. And I came to the conclusion that a possible scenario was that it was actually Tippit that caused plans to go south, that Tippit, of all those officers, got cold feet. And Tippit left his post, drove straight to whatever was it, Lansing and 8th. That is where Officer Olson can also be placed by his testimony and that of his then-girlfriend, Kay Coleman. So I started working to this possible explanation that Tippit had turned, and anybody who turned after the president had been assassinated will clearly be a major problem for anybody who had conspired in that assassination. You're all by then guilty of a capital crime. So taking out a police officer may seem highly unusual, in fact, far-fetched, but not if you've already got a group of conspiratorial officers in place under the command of somebody who I'll speculate later. And that person would have to be taken out as basically an inside job.
Yeah, there's the thought that if he had Oswald, he was going to deliver him or help escort, you know, or whatever the plan was. And that's an interesting concept that, you know, he was going to blow the whistle on this. Maybe he was told something that we were doing this operation, whatever, and then he finds out that Kennedy's been killed and he says, wait a minute, you know, this is too far. I'm not going along with this.
I think you're right. I think that if you were going to plan something in such a way, you would try to keep as many people as possible in the dark on a need-to-know basis. And who knows what the pretext would be for getting so many officers to have a rather passive role in helping out. I mean, helping a getaway car isn't quite the same as standing behind a fence with a gun. And by the time I think Tippit turned, and I think Tippit turned at about 12:45, which fits with when he left Gloco heading off in the direction of Lancaster, it was clear by then from one radio call that Kennedy had his head shot off. And it's quite clear if Tippit hadn't signed up for that, that would... Yeah, so I think Tippit turned at about 12:45, having heard on the radio that the president's had his head shot off. And that then fits with the timeline of him heading off down towards Lancaster, which I said takes you to Lancing and Eighth. What's particularly interesting about Lancing and Eighth, and it's a great benefit of being able to use Google Earth, Lancing Street, after it gets to 10th Street, turns into an alley. And that alley actually goes right behind the house where Tippit was shot. It's parallel to Jefferson Avenue and East 10th Street. So the alley behind the house where Tippit was shot is actually Lancing Alley. And if you look carefully at the route on YouTube, the van actually drove along the alley as if it was still connected to the street. And you can see by the telegraph poles, it's one continuous thoroughfare. So whenever it was built, perhaps in the 1920s, 1930s, I don't know, the telegraph poles treat Lancing Street and that alley as one thoroughfare, and it goes all the way towards Beckley, very near the Texas Theatre. So it's quite an interesting back route for various people if they want to move around that part of Dallas without necessarily following the main thoroughfares. So the movements of police officers before and just after the assassination then made me look at, well, how did police officers get to Oak Cliff and by what method once it became clear that an officer had been shot? By the tape, you can put the timing of Bowley's call. Temple Bowley was the first person to put out a radio call saying a police officer had been shot. It's about 12 minutes past one. I know some people have said that it was after 1:15, but if you just look at the tape is an hour long. The tape starts at 12:15. It's impossible for something to be on the tape beyond 1:15 if the tape is only an hour long. For the first 25 minutes of the tape, the time that was called on the tape absolutely corresponds to the time expired. So there was nothing wrong with the speed of the tape compared to modern technology. The time slots are correct. What happens after about 12:55 is rather than times being called every minute, the timestamps disappear. One of them, which would correspond with 12:57, you can actually hear that it's been only partially edited out. That's a twa, where you would expect 12:57 to be. So they missed off the last end of that. And by taking the times, time is sped up. So where you would expect 1:12 to be, the time would be called 1:16. So time is sped up. the sole purpose of that must have been to give the impression that Tippit had been murdered after 1:15, which would have given Oswald enough time, by the Warren Commission account, to have walked from his boarding house in North Beckley Avenue to the Tippit murder scene. If you start to knock 1 or 2 minutes off of the time of Tippit's death, then it becomes an impossibility that Oswald could have covered that by anything other than a very fast jog or a sprint. So the fiddling of the tape is particularly interesting because, as I say, it covers the time's been tampered, two calls have been inserted at 12:45 to make it look like Nelson and Tippit were doing something else at that time. And again, what came across from looking at Warren Commission testimonies and FBI testimonies, Officer Jerry Hill, MacDonald, and C.T. Walker all added 10 minutes to the time of entry to the Texas Theatre. So per the radio, and I think by then the radio was correct, the first mention on the radio that the Texas Theatre is a point of interest is 1:45. But those three men add 10 minutes to it. And they've done that within 2 or 3 days after the assassination. Why did they do that? Well, it's quite clear. If you thought that you had to add 10 minutes to the time to get Tippit's death to fit, they carried on adding the 10 minutes to the Texas Theatre time. It shows that things were really rather clumsy, because whoever tampered the tape realised that by the time you got to 1:45, you needed to resynchronise with reality, because the media had been there and people therefore knew that the time of the entry to the Texas Theatre was 1:45, and Oswald came out shortly after 1:50. So again, the extent to which some officers were telling lies about the time comes across if you start to look at the times on the tape and comparing it to known events. I mean, I don't think anybody disputes that Oswald was arrested just shortly after 1:50. But 1:45 is pretty easy time to remember. Why would you say it was 1:55? By which time Oswald was in the car on the way to Dallas City Hall. The other thing that I found particularly interesting, because there's one police officer who I think cannot, one police officer who always tells the truth, and that is Owens. And Owens said he was at the depository, heard the call that an officer had been shot in Oak Cliff, and he says he took the district attorney, Bill Alexander, and Westbrook, Captain Westbrook, to the scene. You can hear that call on the tape, and Owens arrives at about 1:16.
Right. I think you meant to say Tippit had been shot.
Yeah. After Tippit had been shot. So Owens arrives at about 1:15, which means from Bowley's call to the time Owens arrives with Westbrook and the DA, Bill Alexander, is about 4 minutes, which fits. If you're breaking speed limits, doing 50 miles an hour, you could do it within 3 to 4 minutes, which makes sense. Look at Captain Westbrook's testimony. He says that he went to the Texas Tippit murder scene with an unknown officer driving and Sergeant Stringer. That clearly doesn't tally with the account of Owens. Sergeant Jerry Hill says that he went with Owens, but Owens doesn't mention going with Hill. Hill's testimony is particularly interesting because by the radio, it's very clear that the first officer to arrive at the scene of the Tippit murder was Poe, who arrived seconds before Owens. Hill testified that he had arrived with Owens, but he says in his testimony that he'd been talking to witnesses at the scene when he saw Poe's car turn up. Well, he can't have done that if he arrived with Owens, who arrived shortly after Poe, who was first on the scene. So nobody actually put Hill arriving at the murder scene in their car, certainly not Owens. So there's something odd about the way Hill arrived at the Tippit murder scene. Did he let the cat out of the bag by saying that he saw Poe's car arrive? I think he did. Interestingly, one of the Davis sisters, either Barbara Davis or Virginia Davis, who lived in the house next to where Tippit was shot, said that as soon as they heard the shots, they went outside and the police were already there. Well, we know it took Owens and Poe 4 minutes to arrive, so there were already police outside the Davis's house at the Tippit murder scene. So was that Hill? I think it probably was. Interestingly, there was a Dallas Morning News journalist, Jim Ewell. He said he went with Westbrook to the Tippit murder scene with Stringer, with Westbrook driving. Fascinating insight into Westbrook's testimony, where Westbrook said an unknown officer drove and he didn't know his name, whereas a reporter puts Westbrook who's driving. But remember, Owens has also said that Westbrook took him. By then looking at the extent to which Westbrook wants to cover up the fact that he found a jacket discarded by the fugitive at the garage on Jefferson Avenue. Well, I say there's an attempt to cover it up. The Warren Commission docket showing the jacket being found has a piece of paper placed over it in such a way that you can't see that the person who was reported as finding the jacket was Westbrook. A strip has been placed perfectly to cover Westbrook's name. But there's another photograph of the same record where the strip is missing, and it's very clear that Westbrook found the jacket. Again, by the police radio, Officer Mackey puts out a call at about 1:21 saying that the jacket has been found. So within about 5 minutes of Owens, and according to Owens, Westbrook arriving, calls put out on the radio that the jacket's been found. And by the paperwork of the DPD, that jacket was found by Westbrook. So that suggests that Westbrook arrived with Owens at 1:16 and found the jacket. What else happens? Well, run forward another 20 minutes and Westbrook starts commenting on the jacket at about 1:40 with Sergeant Stringer. I think that was a cover to make it look like he'd found the jacket then, to effectively cover up the fact he'd found the jacket earlier. The only way I could reconcile all the evidence of different parties as to how they got to the scene is that Westbrook actually arrived in Oak Cliff twice. First time, as Owens said, with the DA, with Owens driving. The second time, as Ewell said, with Westbrook driving, taking Ewell and Stringer. And therefore, the only way I could make the stories marry was Westbrook arriving with Owens, finding the jacket conveniently at just before 1:21. Then, remembering he hasn't got a car, finding a car to get back to Dealey Plaza, where he then meets Stringer and Ewell, and he then drives back to the Tippit murder scene. And it's that second arrival that Westbrook wants to make as his only arrival. That's why he's obfuscating about who was driving. The interesting thing about Westbrook is that's not the only journey he obfuscates either. He said that when he was sitting at his desk at City Hall at just after 12:30 and they heard that the president had been shot, he sent his men to Texas School Book Depository, sat around, got a bit bored, didn't know what to do, and walked to the Texas School Book Depository, which is a good mile. It would have taken him over 20 minutes. He says that he's stopping on the way, talking to people. Interestingly, he says he's listening to false alarms on the radio. I don't know how he would know alarms were false at that stage, which is an interesting slip of the tongue. But later, Sergeant Stringer gives an interview with Dale Myers saying that Stringer and Westbrook drove to Texas School Book Depository, just after the president had been shot, and therefore Westbrook got there without walking. Westbrook was actually driven there with Stringer. The other interesting account of Westbrook is you can't even get the story straight as to how he got to the Texas Theater once the message had got out on the radio. He says that he arrived with Stringer and an unknown driver again, and they parked at the back, whereas Jim Yule said he arrived at the Texas Theater, having heard on the radio, with Westbrook driving again, and Westbrook parked at the front. So that's three different accounts for three different journeys, where every one of Westbrook's claims can be refuted by either another officer or, as in the case of Jim Muir, a Dallas Morning News reporter. The other odd account of movements after 12:30 is that of Jerry Hill. There's absolutely no doubt as to how Jerry Hill got to the Texas School Book Depository. He arrived in car 207. That can be seen in an awful lot of coverage now of the post-assassination activity. It actually appears in Jim DiGiugino's Destiny Betrayed. You can see the police car pull up and it's Jerry Hill getting out. By the time of the departure on the police tape, you can deduce that Jerry Hill got at the Texas School Book Depository at about 12:50, having left City Hall at about 12:45. So Jerry Hill seems to leave City Hall at about the time that the call is put on the radio describing somebody who looks like Oswald is the person of interest. Now, what then happens is Hill, in his testimony, states that he discovered the cartridges on the sixth floor, discarded by the window, at some time after 1 p.m. Is that true? No. Again, looking at the radio, the officer who found the cartridges shouted down to Officer Harkness, who gave evidence to the Warren Commission. You can see Harkness making the call at about 12:55, and you can then see Harkness asking for Barnes of the forensics office to drive to the Texas Theater to come and have a look at what they've just found. All that happens before 1 p.m. So Jerry Hill did not find the cartridges after 1 p.m. He says he was the first person to find the cartridges. He wasn't. It had happened before 1 p.m. What's the effect of what Hill did? Well, Hill's giving himself an alibi for what he was doing after 1 p.m. Why is what Hill's doing at 1 p.m. interesting? Well, Oswald's housekeeper, Earlene Roberts, at the rooming house in North Beckley, said that just before Oswald left, having entered the premises to go to his room, a car tooted outside. It was a police car, had two men inside it, and it was car number 207. So that, by her account, is about 105. Who'd arrived at the Texas School Book Depository in car 207? Hill. Who does not have an alibi for after 1 p.m. but is trying to lie to give himself one? Hill. People have therefore speculated how the person we thought was Oswald got from the rooming house to Tippett's murder scene. Well, it could only have been done by car. And therefore, the evidence seems to stack up that car 207 took that person to the Tippett murder scene. Now, I don't believe that person was the shooter of Tippett. If you look at Aquila Clemens's testimony, she saw two men present at the time that Tippett was shot. One of them did the shooting and then told the other man to run. And the person who runs then ran down South Patton Street onto East Jefferson, ran through the Texaco garage, and then disappeared into the alley, and in the meantime was supposed to have taken off his jacket and thrown it down in the parking lot of the Texaco garage. I don't see why anybody on the run carrying a gun would take a jacket off in the middle of running. It's quite hard to take a jacket off at the best of times, not least if you're running and carrying a revolver. So again, more evidence, I think, that the jacket planting was a fix. And I say we've now got a pattern of Hill, Westbrook, basically lying about how they got to the Tippett murder scene. Hill, present just before Tippett was shot, arriving in car 207. Westbrook arriving after Tippett was shot, arriving with Owens. And the only explanation I can come up with as to how Westbrook managed to arrive twice was that Westbrook had to dispose of car 207 and take it back to the depository. And again, if you look in the files, it's Westbrook that gave the alibi for car 207, because car 207 became of immense interest given what Erlene Roberts had said. And therefore, I think that Westbrook took it back to the school book depository, then encountered Stringer and Yule. And who's the best person to give you an alibi for arriving somewhere at the time you want to be seen to arrive? And that would be a pressman. So I think Westbrook, again, wasn't involved in shooting Tippett, but he was involved in what I call the preparations for it and actually the setup for what happened.
Well, it's starting to make a lot more sense. This is some great detective work. And as, you know, like a paleontologist finding these different bones, we're starting to get a picture of the creature here, right? And just how many people had to be doing this or doing that or making sure that this crime got off the ground and the people responsible were not found. And the obfuscation, the deletion, it's really just interesting that you decided to go through the transcripts and then reflect back to what's actually on the tape. And yeah, it lays out right from day one, from 12:30 on, that some operation's going on here.
Yeah. I thought at first you could just have one or two mistakes here and there that could just be what I call genuine mistakes or coincidences. But the sheer weight of evidence of false testimonies, the time not stacking up, you then have to start asking what was being covered up and why and by who. And I haven't mentioned yet Reserve Sergeant Croy. Croy is a very interesting character for all sorts of reasons. He was interviewed by the Warren Commission because some of the staff members suspected that there had actually been Dallas Police cooperation in the murder of Oswald in the basement of City Hall. In fact, one of the files in the JFK files says that they suspected that Officer Olson had conspired to put Ruby up to shooting Oswald. But the interesting thing about Croy is that Croy is the officer who can be seen on TV coverage managing the press pack, which contains Jack Ruby. And in moving the press pack forward at the time that Oswald enters the basement of the City Hall, you can see Croy is next to Ruby. And therefore, the effect of moving the press pack forward is to move Ruby forward into place where Oswald is then shot. So you can see the press pack where Croy moves press pack forward and in the process moves Ruby into position where Ruby then shoots Oswald. What's particularly interesting, and it's Counsel Griffin, who I think was one of the better Warren counsel, and as much as if something odd came out in evidence, he pushed that bit further, which isn't the way that all Warren Commission counsel operated. Croy let slip to the stenographer before he gave evidence that he'd also been present at the Tippett murder scene, something that he wasn't being questioned about, but Griffin therefore pursued that. So I think Croy was taken completely off guard when he gave evidence, because he had to account for his movements from 12:30, when the president was shot, to the time of entry to the Texas Theatre. And none of Croy's story makes sense. I looked at the map of Dallas again to check how his story tallied with the maps. He said that Main Street was blocked, and therefore he was held up in heavy traffic on Main Street. You look at the testimony of Sawyer, Inspector Sawyer and also Officer Hudson. You can see that they actually managed to get down Main Street very quickly at precisely the time Croy said he was stuck in traffic. Like both accounts can't be true. He also said he was hemmed in on both sides. While Main Street is four lanes of traffic, two in each direction. You can't be hemmed in on both sides with that road configuration. Where you can be hemmed in on both sides is Elm Street, which was three lanes one way, going from the direction of City Hall towards Texas School Book Depository. Interestingly, and it's quite amusing, because Council Griffin asks where Croy got stuck, and Croy shouts out Griffin. So Griffin has to say, you mean Griffin Street. What is, again, interesting coincidence about Griffin, if Croy is really on Elm Street, Griffin and Elm is where near where Oswald got off the bus, or the person who was on the bus, who people thought was Oswald, got off. And reading the testimonies of Roy Milton Jones, he says that at the time Oswald got off the bus, two policemen had approached it. Again, looking at the timing of the bus, the Warren Commission needed to get the bus to that point as early as possible to be able to then construe a story that Oswald had got a taxi from Greyhound bus station to his rooming house, or although the story was he'd actually been dropped five or six blocks to the south. If you just made the bus late by a minute, then the timeline doesn't work. But you can prove by looking at Mary Bledsoe's testimony that the bus must have been much later, because a lady was sufficiently concerned about the time that the bus was stuck, because she thought she'd miss a 1 o'clock train. For the Warren Commission account to stack up, the bus would have only been a minute late. How could a bus be a minute late if the traffic was jammed up? It just doesn't fit. So I think the bus was at least 10 minutes late. What's interesting is Mary Bledsoe says that she got off the bus when the lady did, and council asks Mary Bledsoe, did the lady get her bus? And she says, yes. And the council says, how does she know? She said, because she got on the same bus as me. And that goes against all Warren Commission accounts, whereby only Oswald and the lady got off. People assume that Mary Bledsoe stayed on the bus, but Mary Bledsoe's evidence is very clear that she got off the bus as well. And she says she then caught another one immediately behind. Well, given that buses couldn't be early and she was getting the bus she wanted, the delay must have been about 10 minutes for the other bus to have caught up. So I don't think the person that we think is Oswald got off the bus until about 1:52. And that fits with the removal of the person on the bus being the reaction to Tippett turning and pulling out of his operation, his operational role, which was to give the fugitive some kind of safe passage by meeting them outside Glencoe. And obviously, if Tippett turned and wasn't going to progress the plan as planned, you'd have two problems. You had to move the person on the bus in a different way, but there'd also be the imperative of eliminating Tippett as quickly as possible before he started to blab.
Yeah, that's a real feasible, possible explanation.
Well, the interesting thing is, and I spent quite a lot of time in one of the articles going through the timing of the bus, and the Warren Commission tried to have it both ways. On one hand, the bus was late, but on the other hand, for Mary Bledsoe's testimony to stack up, it had to have been late for people to have been concerned about not getting their train. So there's something very, very badly wrong. What's also interesting is about Mary Bledsoe's description of the guy on the bus that people put as Oswald. She said his face was horribly distorted. If you look at Oswald after he was arrested, he had a bruise above one of his eyes because he was hit with something in the Texas Theatre, but his face didn't look particularly distorted. In fact, he looked like he was pretty good at handling stress. Roy Milton Jones, who was on the bus, said that there was nothing particularly out of the ordinary about the person he saw, so he didn't say the person's face was horribly distorted. I therefore think that this ties in with, as I said earlier, Oswald, the person we know as the person that was shot by Jack Ruby, if he left Dealey Plaza at about 12:40 in an Ash Rambler, taking him to the Texas Theatre with Nelson helping him, then he can't have been the person on the bus, and he can't have been the person who arrives at 1026 North Beckley, nor could he be the person at the Tippit murder scene. Therefore, we're left with this question, who's on the bus? And I found in Warren Commission papers a line of inquiry that suspected a man called Larry Crayfard had been impersonating Oswald. And the evidence that Oswald was being impersonated lines up all over the place. There's the impersonation in Mexico City, by whom I don't know, not necessarily the same person, well, definitely not the same person as on the bus. But why would the person on the bus be impersonating Oswald? I think it's pretty obvious, actually. If Oswald was to be a patsy for the Kennedy assassination and Oswald needed to be dealt with, I eliminated very shortly after the assassination by being duped, he'd have to be chaperoned to the Texas Theatre on some kind of pretext. Clearly, chaperoning somebody is evidence of a conspiracy and help, and therefore you need a parallel person to be moving in the same direction to be able to account for Oswald having got there under his own steam by getting a bus, if that makes sense. So I believe that the person on the bus was a decoy. His sole job was to make it look like he was doing what Oswald would have done had Oswald run up Elm Street, got the bus, taken the bus to his lodging, and then got to the Texas Theatre. That provides the narrative of a lone gunman, no assistance, can't drive, got public transport, a scuffle in the Texas Theatre and was shot, case closed. Who do I think that person was? Well, the Warren Commission suspected it was Larry Crayfard. Larry Crayfard had come to Dallas as a roustabout with the affair at the Texas State Fair mid-October. He was employed by Jack Ruby. He disappeared from Dallas the day after the assassination, found himself somewhere up on the Canadian border, left without taking money, left without being paid. People said he had an extraordinary resemblance to Oswald as long as he didn't open his mouth because he had teeth missing. That fits with Mary Bledsoe thinking that the person she saw was the person she knew was Oswald because he lodged with her before he'd moved to his rooming house. If you thought you saw somebody who was less pleasant looking, had their teeth missing, then you might describe them as having their face horribly distorted, thinking that she'd seen Oswald rather than the decoy. The other thing that really struck me as well, when I started to look at the maps of downtown Dallas and see where the bus stop was, where Oswald supposedly got on the bus, it's the closest bus stop to the Carousel Club, which is where Crayfard stayed the night before the assassination. So Crayfard lived, or supposedly lived, at the Carousel Club, sleeping on the sofa. The bus stop that Oswald supposedly got on is only one block away from the Carousel Club. The Carousel Club was the corner of Field and Commerce. The bus stop was the field of Elm and Field. So, again, another coincidence, another involvement of Jack Ruby. Why would Oswald have run eight blocks in town against the direction that he actually wanted to go in? Well, say I don't believe Oswald was on the bus. I believe that it was the convenient way of keeping Crayford off the streets as little as much as possible by Crayford boarding a bus at the stop nearest the Carousel Club. What flows from that is, in my view, clarity on what Jack Ruby's role was in the assassination. And as I said, no more than I believe any police officers were standing behind fences firing guns. I don't think Ruby was either. I think there's evidence that Ruby's sole role was to put the decoy operation in place. And more I think about other circumstances and events, I think that is the likely explanation. Because we all know that there was a supposed assassination attempt in Chicago. There's a supposed assassination attempt in Tampa. And with extraordinary parallels with so-called patsies for each. The evidence that Ruby was responsible for the decoy operation stacks up in all sorts of ways. First of all, the way he found Crayford by wandering around the state fair looking for somebody to employ. And I looking for somebody who might be taken for as Oswald by appearance. Ruby knew Bertha Cheek, the sister of Erling Roberts, who was the housekeeper at the Beckley Rooming House. Ruby knew Tommy Rowe, who worked in the shoe shop near the Texas Theatre, where Johnny Brewer supposedly saw Oswald acting strangely outside before he ducked into the Texas Theatre at about 1:40. But we know Oswald was already at the Texas Theatre because people had seen him there from just after 1. So it appears to me that all the evidence stacks up with Ruby's sole role being to provide a decoy. There's a link at the end, Tommy Rowe, and it said that after Ruby was arrested, Tommy Rowe actually moved into Ruby's vacant apartment. There's the Bertha Cheek, Erling Roberts connection. And as I say, there's the proximity of Ruby's Carousel Club with the stop that the person everybody said was Oswald got on at, i.e. Field and Elm.
Yeah, it's so interesting, these separate sightings of a Lee Oswald. John Armstrong's research, that he thinks there was two people from far way back, you know, even childhood. But if you don't subscribe to that, if you just say, well, listen, it's either, you know, mistaken identity. How can somebody be on the Rambler and how can somebody be on the bus and who was, you know, test driving a car and who even the Hoover said who's ordering Jeeps, you know, in the name of a Lee Oswald when he's in the Soviet Union. So something is going on.
Something was going on, and I don't necessarily join the dots in the same way that John Armstrong has, but some of his evidence is extremely useful because it's a depository of very, very good evidence. I mean, he just produces contemporaneous papers of the time, so that is evidence. It's not made up. And one thing that John pointed me towards was the evidence of Laura Cottrell. Now, she was an employee of the Texas Employment Commission, and she met Oswald, the person who everybody recognises Oswald and was shot by Jack Ruby. But she realised very quickly after the assassination that she'd also interviewed somebody who was pretending to be Oswald, and she was trained to look for social security fraud, so she was suspicious. And she described that the Oswald we all know as Oswald was neat, military-looking, polite. The other one went out of his way to be scruffy, slovenly, and rude. And a good way to I think the unfortunate thing for whoever was impersonating Oswald was that they came across somebody with a good memory, and the fact that she actually was the person who'd also seen the other Oswald, i.e. the real Oswald. Because generally, if you are trying to impersonate somebody, then you obviously are trying to impersonate somebody for an effect, to make an impression. The best way to make an impression is to do something out of the ordinary and behave badly, which is quite common in this case. You just have to look at the behaviour of Oswald in New Orleans, handing out leaflets and then getting into a fight. It all points towards attention seeking, to make an impression, to help a narrative. Yeah, where I think I might differ with John, I think it's highly likely if Oswald was an asset of some kind, that then there may be an element of force or combining identity in setting up Oswald. If he was a forced effect, to say, then it may have been convenient to merge somebody else's school records with his to make the story of the forced affection work better.
Yeah, I subscribe to that. And when you get into Angleton and all these other things, speculating he was trying to weed out a mole, and if the Soviets did want to do a background check, they wouldn't be sure of who they had. It's no problem.
Yeah.
The thing, though, I do like about John is that, and it's very rare in researchers, he's very easygoing on the fact, well, if you don't agree with me, no problem. Like, some people don't like this. They stick to, my story's correct, and I've got it right. And many times he says to me, look, just point out where I'm wrong, because I don't want to be wrong. And in the meantime, he keeps digging up stuff, but I tell him even privately and said, well, I don't quite subscribe to that, but I'm going to go along with it until, in case you change my mind further down the road. So, a few things I have softened, and I thought, that this can't be by accident, and, the whole Mexico City thing, and then revelations that, when you guys dig into this, you'll find out there was no Mexico. This Lee Oswald that we know, the classic, he was never in Mexico City. But imposters, phony trails, and there's just a lot to be dug. And what you've dug up is very interesting. What John has is as well. And I just don't go that far back to say that. But there is something to the CIA and intelligence agencies pulling people out, displaced people from Europe, and bringing them in and putting them in as little pawns to say, you may be needed, and if you're needed, we have this guy in the pipeline. Like the number of people who defected to the, the Robert Webster. There's so many moving parts that... If you're polite with Johnny and you have no problem,
I agree. I would only really want to compliment him on the quality of the research he's done. All I would say is a lot more evidence has appeared in recent years that may need to be feathered in with his broad outline. I mean, he was absolutely correct in flagging the suspicious behaviour of Westbrook and Croy. I don't think he's made the connections of tried to reconcile all the differing accounts of who arrived in Oak Cliff for the Tippit murder scene with who, but the volume of evidence he's turned up is astonishing.
To top that off, I can see how there could be phony records, duplicate records of something. So just like if they wanted to weed out a mole, they'd say, well, which record do you have? Is you get the 5'10" guy or the, whatever. I'm just neutral and continue to be interested to learn that the fact that he brings up something that we just find of more interest and more interest. And the number one thing with your article and talking to you was that you went through the records to compare the actual audio to the transcript. And once you get into there, you really see right away that from a very quick time on, There's a story that they don't want people to know about.
Very, very, very early on. The next thing I'm working on, first of all, what I actually want to do is donate somehow my corrected transcript for posterity with what should be on the transcripts. And the best transcript to work for is the Russ Shearer transcript. That is the most comprehensive. It avoids most of the problems of the official transcripts. But that had one or two errors in it. For a start, it it picked it up as Lancaster an eighth when it's quite clearly Lansing an eighth. And that transcript assumes that Angle was at Corinth an eighth when Corinth doesn't sound like Lancaster or Lansing, but Corinth was actually the next call of Angle a few minutes later. So I can see why those mistakes were made. What is interesting about this false identity thing is the British used it in the Second World War, and Angleton was in London for the last part of the Second World War, and there was this thing you may have seen, it turned into a film, Operation Mincemeat, where the Germans were duped by a dead body that they'd taken from a mortuary. It was a body of a tramp, and they put him into a submarine, dressed him up in naval uniform, put a briefcase with him. I think they sort of handcuffed a briefcase, let him out of the submarine somewhere in the Mediterranean, and it had fake invasion plans in it, and the Germans fell for it. So this whole concept of false identities being built up over a period of time is perfectly consistent with what the British were doing in World War II. So it wouldn't be extraordinary at all for Angleton to pick up on some of this stuff, and for elements of Oswald's background to be merged with somebody else's, because his background is full of contradictions. On the one hand, he's supposed to be dyslexic and not very bright, but on the other, he's supposed to have learned Russian from a Berlitz guide. I find that incredible, at least as the alphabet's different. I don't know anybody who's even managed to learn French by having a Berlitz guide. Because you just end up having the wrong pronunciation because you read the word as it looks in English as opposed to the real thing. So Oswald clearly had professional lessons in Russian, or he already was Russian by some strange, or Eastern European by some strange connection in his past, which I don't know about. So no, I think the false identity thing is different, but I think having an imposter in Dallas for the purpose of setting up Oswald as a patsy doesn't necessarily need to coincide with Oswald having elements of a false identity.
Well, that is very interesting. I think we haven't really got all of part one, but it's so lengthy. Do you want to summarize part one, and maybe I'll have you back on for part two later on?
Yeah. Just some other interesting thoughts. I also then started to look at if there was a certain number of officers on viaducts as part of a getaway. That kind of gives away how many shooters there might have been. So if you say that Tippett was there to assist the decoy, Crayford, if Nelson's role was to help the Rambler with Oswald get to the Texas Theatre, that then leaves you with Angle, Lewis, and Parker having a role. Well, if you've got three people assisting a getaway, then you've got three shooters. Now, I don't want to get into ballistics because I think that's been done to death. But what was interesting when I was looking at Warren Commission testimonies is how many times the word firecracker appeared as describing the first shot. It's extraordinary. It's almost every testimony says that it sounded like a firecracker. What's interesting is James Tague, who was the guy that was hit with a fragment of a stray bullet, was knowledgeable about guns. And in his Warren Commission testimony, he says that the first shot, first sound, was definitely not a rifle shot. He said it was more of an explosion. And you just need to look at Bill and Gail Newman's interview, the famous interview within 15 minutes on live television, because they were the closest civilians to the headshot. They both said it was a firecracker. And I counted altogether more than 30 people, including Secret Service, all said that the first shot was the noise of a firecracker, not a rifle. Why does that matter? Well, if the magic bullet theory is being trounced, it just doesn't work. That means you need at least one more bullet. In fact, you need two, because you would have Kennedy shot in the head, Kennedy shot in the throat, Kennedy shot in the back, and Connolly shot in the back. Plus there's the one that almost hit Tague. So that's five shots. So you've got five shots, but
And not only the one that might have gone right into the grass, missed completely?
Yeah. So there's the, so that's actually six shots. So you've got five or six shots, at least four that struck Connolly and Kennedy, but only three noises. Well, that therefore indicates that there would have been silencers used. And it suddenly struck me, if you're using silencers, then most of the shots that hit JFK and Connolly must have been silence shots. Before you get to, why would a marksman miss to the extent that it hit the curb far away on the other side of Dealey Plaza by Tay? The answer actually becomes quite obvious. If you're using silencers and there's only been two noises, you need to fire another shot to make three. So effectively, the shot that hit Tay was a deliberate miss because it was there to create a noise rather than actually hit anybody. And if you've got the grass shot, is also similar, and that would suggest that all the shots that hit JFK and Connolly were actually from a silencer. And therefore, the noises were sort of there for effect. They weren't actually part of the bullets that caused an impact. And therefore, I'd just be interested in pursuing whether the firecracker was actually a distraction. And was it the firecracker that was behind the picket fence? Because people did describe smoke, and it was the firecracker that caused people to look towards that direction. From looking at trajectories, I think JFK was shot from the front, not from the side where the picket fence was, but from the overpass. Now, how could you fire from the overpass without people seeing? Well, you had a rifle with a silencer, and you had an explosion towards the picket fence that caused people to look. That could actually explain how you'd get away with it, because people would have been distracted. I've got no evidence or proof other than observations, but it is extraordinary how many people said it was a firecracker. And I think it was Senator Yarbrough who said that you could smell gunpowder as he drove past.
Yeah.
You wouldn't smell gunpowder from a bullet fired from the sixth floor of a building behind you. Yeah. And
just another observation that needs some kind of explanation. And for now, you know, that's one observation.
Yeah, well, my interest was, I think there were three officers helping in getaways of the gunman, because an assassination is easy to pull off. The problem is actually getting away without getting caught. That's the challenge for setting up any assassination, is actually being able to get a safe getaway, because otherwise, you know, if you're employing a professional shooter, they won't do it without a guarantee that they can actually be safely moved.
And then you have all these discrepancies of the Dallas police that I'm not sure where in your article you said, but does it need more scrutiny? And yes, it does. This is, you know, scratching the surface of what's going on.
Well, you can probably tell I have connections with the UK. If this was the UK on the basis of what I'd found, I would think that a decent police force would open it as a cold case. I mean, once you start to discover that police records have been fiddled around with, then and you ask the question, well, who would have the interest in that? And it being the police itself, you'd have another police force taking it on as a false case, as a cold case.
Yeah. Well, you would hope so. But then if you consider that even America, they don't want to release the files. They're, you know, 60 couple of years, you know, later, they're just releasing them. And now, you know, what's been released right now is, you know, still small potatoes. They're just releasing documents, and people who are, you know, amateur historians, concerned citizens going through it, they further keep revealing that it's not just this lone assassin, a lone Marxist or whatever. There's had to be help, CIA operations all over the world, continually, you know, removal of heads of government. So it slowly pulls into there. But I mean, you know, you don't really have faith that the American, the Justice Department, the FBI, and the CIA, they're going to really reveal what went on. They're going to begrudgingly reveal documents, and it's up to us to put them together, you know.
Well, yeah, I was struck by just the integrity of the medical staff at Parkland Hospital, who were quite clear that the Warren Commission account of the bullets didn't stack up with what they'd seen with their own eyes. I mean, whether it was the hole in the back of the head with the cerebellum falling out, or the throat shot was a front shot. You then had the Landis testimony recently, revelation, Secret Serviceman Landis, that the bullet that was supposed to be the magic bullet he actually found on the shelf behind Kennedy in the limo. So it can't have been the one that went through Connolly. You just need to look at the Zapruder film to see that Connolly was responding to Kennedy being shot before he was then actually shot. And he turned his back. So there's no way that Connolly was shot by the same bullet as Kennedy. I think Connolly was shot by a bullet from the other side of Dealey Plaza, because he almost turned himself at a 90 degree angles to Texas Gold Depository. But yeah.
Yeah, well, it's really ridiculous that Commission Exhibit 399 is presented as the bullet that did all that. And people get behind it and say, oh, yeah, it could have happened. It, you know, the John McAdams, the Gerald Posners, the and they don't call it the magic bullet for nothing. I mean, it would have to have been magic for that to happen. And I just never, that was probably the catalyst for me that thought, wait a minute, there's no way this did it. Let me look into this further.
Well, the Landis testimony recently, the Landis disclosure, does explain why that bullet wasn't very undamaged, because it just made a superficial wound in the back and then came out.
I think that there's still quite a bit more on part one, so I'm going to urge everyone to go read this at Kennedy's and King. I'll make links to it, and then have you back on to talk further, like for like another hour about part two, and you have a part three as well.
Yeah, thank you. No,
but before we wrap up, is there anything you want to add? Because I've got the article in front of me, I can see that there's still a lot more in part one, so I could just urge people to read it, but is there something that you would like to bring up for now before we wrap up?
I think what I haven't covered is more detail of how the officers arrived at the Texas Theater. What was particularly interesting was how the officers that had given false alarms as to where the fugitive was, because McDonald said he'd gone into an Abundant Life Temple Church. Walker had said he'd gone into the Marcellus Library. Hill had set the hairs running, saying that he'd gone into some junk shops on Jefferson. And Westbrook said that he'd headed north on Patton, which nobody else said. All of those four, who'd been so bad identifying where the fugitive was, happened to be the earliest arrivals at the Texas Theatre. And again, what's interesting about Officer Hudson's testimony, who again, I think like Owens, happens to be in at the right place at the right time and tells the truth. Hudson reveals that he was being driven by Hawkins, who's the man who actually puts the handcuffs on Oswald. He was only a block, Hawkins was already driving to the Texas Theatre before the call was put out to make the Texas Theatre a point of interest. So somebody knew what was going to happen next.
Yeah, it's really well researched. I think this is just another key in the cog. You know, you've done some really interesting work here. I urge everyone to read it, whether you agree or disagree, like some of the other researchers. You know, we're all putting things together, and we've got 80, 85% of stuff there. But there's still a few missing pieces. But at least we're putting it together, and you can't rely on anything from the state, any Justice Department, National Archives, to really come out and say, here's what's in here. You guys should read this.
Well, so far, nobody has pointed out that any of the evidence I've presented is incorrect, just as much as I can't see anything that John has put out as incorrect. We can all join the dots differently. But the evidence as I've set out, nobody's challenged and said that the base evidence is incorrect.
Yeah, but yet, if you're looking at the Warren Commission and the, what they offer, that is incorrect. So that's why your research and others, you know, we're all going through stuff, is worth, because it's just pointing out that these guys can't be in two places at the same time. And like you mentioned, some of you, you follow their career later on, like Westbrook and Croy and that, right? And these guys have intelligence agency connections.
Well, Westbrook pops up in Vietnam and he's photographed with David Morales, who we know was involved with Northwoods.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But back to the Warren Commission, the thing that really struck me about the Warren Commission, I think where it clearly fell over, in my mind, very early on, was the so-called taxi journey from the Greyhound bus station. The taxi manifest had the person getting in the cab at 12:30. The Warren Commission then tried to say that William Whaley was wrong by 15 minutes. Because he said he rounded, but if you look at the manifest, he doesn't. He put 5 minutes, 10 minutes down. He wouldn't be 15 minutes out. And the giveaway, if you read the testimony very, very carefully, because the so-called fugitive on the run was prepared to give his cab up to an old lady who approached the cab rank at about the same time. And what is interesting is William Whaley says that as soon as this person gets in the cab, the sirens start, and there's obviously been an event happen, and they have a conversation as to what's causing the noise, what's going on. Well, by the Warren Commission account, that would be 1:45 after Oswald had been and got off the bus. But on the tape, you can hear the sirens there at 12:33. So everything points in the direction that Whaley's manifest was correct. He picked up the person at 12:30, exactly the point at which the assassination occurred, and within minutes all the sirens sounded. And he's actually describing something that you can prove contemporaneously. I mean, it didn't take 15 minutes for the sirens to start. So quarter two. It's astonishing how the Warren Commission is bending backwards to make its line work when it clearly didn't. And I think I commented in my article that he commented how scruffily dressed the person was and looked like he'd slept in his clothes overnight. And I would have thought it's pretty obvious if you're picking somebody up from the Greyhound bus station, the reason why they look like they've slept in their clothes because they've just arrived on an overnight bus.
All right, we've been speaking to John Washburn. His article, Death of Tippit, Part 1, we've covered a bit today. Where was Westbrook? And I look forward to speaking to you again in the near future, and we'll talk about your Part 2 and Part 3. So thank you so much for sharing time with me today.
Great, thanks, Len. That's good.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll talk again.